Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
From the Webby Awards, I'm David Michelle Davies. This is the Webby Podcast.
Keep sending us Chrome experiments.
Let me organize your things.
Design with passion.
From Italy.
Three words. Make ideas happen.
Hey, welcome back. For today's guest, digital artist Jenny O'Dell, everything is fascinating. Landfills, really old tech magazines, you name it. To her, it's all art and it all tells a larger story about humanity. Jenny uses digital tools like Google Satellite and Street View to mine the internet in order to create murals of everyday things, like swimming pools, and explore how we think about them. Her work deconstructs items we see in our everyday lives, which makes it super relatable. Her career as an independent artist kicked off when a curator commissioned her work after seeing it featured in the Webby-winning Tumblr Things Organized Neatly, which you should check out. We talked about that, as well as her many projects, her feelings on mixing tech and art, and more. She starts off by telling me what it's like to be raised in the heart of Silicon Valley by two technologists.
Well, I think it probably matters that I grew up in Cupertino.
Okay.
And both of my parents worked at tech jobs. So there were just, I feel like I was around computers a lot. And I was pretty often using them to do weird stuff that, you know, they were not meant to do. Like the way kids approach technology is really interesting to me because they don't really know what it's supposed to be doing. So I did a lot of wacky computer stuff as a kid, I think.
Mm-hmm. What did your parents do?
My mom was a technical writer for HP.
Okay.
And my dad was an electronics engineer for Tandem. But
Two parents in tech. So you started and you're in the middle. I assume you're not on like one Infinity Way or whatever, but you're pretty close to the Apple headquarters.
Really close. Really close. And I remember being a kid. And my mom brought me to HP, and in the lobby they had this VR headset, although I wouldn't have known it wouldn't have been a VR headset to me in my head, but some kind of headset, and I put it on, and it was just a 3D chessboard that stretched into infinity, which is actually really terrifying to, like, an 8-year-old. And if you looked around, you just saw chess pieces that were bigger than you. And wow. I thought that was really scary.
Could you move the chess pieces?
No, you couldn't do anything, okay. At least the way I remember it. That's probably not an accurate memory, but
right.
Point being, yeah, I was around a lot of weird computer stuff.
And were there a lot of like your peers in high school where parents were tech workers at Apple? And so you're really, I mean, it's hard to overstate. You're super inundated at this point with this stuff, right?
Like my high school had like an inverted social pyramid where nerds were at the top.
Right.
So Yeah.
You know, in the early days of like in the mid 90s, the joke was that like the internet was for like people who weren't cool in high school. It was like all of a sudden all these people who weren't really cool in high school suddenly got to be cool on the internet.
Yep. That was my experience.
What type of study did you pursue in school?
I was actually an English major.
Okay.
So I think that does actually show up in my art because I'm always collecting things. And when I would write stuff in college, it just felt like I was collecting quotes from things and then constantly rearranging them until I came up with some new idea. But definitely I'm still very into like books and libraries and archives and stuff like that. So and I did that at Berkeley, which is a very like English major place to go to school. And then I did my MFA in design and technology at San Francisco Art Institute immediately after that.
When you finished at Art Institute, did you start making art and like sort of pursue that as a career? Did you do something else first or?
I worked at a corporate job for 3 years and then I was kind of just making stuff on the side. But at the time, I feel like I had really had the fear put in me about like trying to be an artist is just so ridiculous. You know, like it's completely unreasonable in a lot of ways. And so I didn't have a lot of aspirations in terms of like doing it as a career when I left. Like I was trying to be realistic. So I worked at like a big corporation and then just like was making stuff for myself on the side, and then it just kind of ended up catching on in some places.
Did the idea of becoming an artist become something that seemed more attainable, or?
Like, to me personally?
Yeah, to you, yeah.
Yeah, it kind of, like, it honestly, it kind of started with this, there's a Tumblr, I don't know if it still exists, Things Organized Neatly.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, and as you can imagine, I make work that looks very much like something that should be on that Tumblr.
So that's, like, called Knolling?
Is that what they call it? Which I didn't even know what that was.
I love that, yeah.
And so one of my pieces had ended up on this Tumblr, and then I am pretty sure that's where this curator saw it, who's, like, actually a really well-known curator in Europe.
Yeah.
And he put me in this show in, like, the south of France. It's, like, part of a photography festival.
Can you just describe, like, your work or or stuff on the site for people who don't know site?
Yeah. So that particular image was it's 125 swimming pools that are cut out in Photoshop from screenshots from Google Earth. So, and they're all kind of arranged in this very OCD-looking configuration. So I had at the time, I had a whole series of those, like, swimming pools, parking lots, basketball courts, like anything kind of like pedestrian built environment stuff, man-made stuff.
Mm-hmm. And the site itself had a lot of, I guess it sort of goes after the name Things Organized Neatly. Like it could be like a picture of like, you know, 45 different like credit cards that were really like nicely put together or just that kind of thing, right?
Yeah. So it just so happened that all of my work had satellite imagery in it, and the theme of this show that I got put in was, it was a photography show, but it was all kind of unmanned photography, so people using like street view or webcams, or someone put a camera on their cat, like just anything except for a person like pressing a button on a camera.
What was the interest for you in collecting photos of pools or water slides or the other stuff you mentioned there and assembling them? Like what was the meaning there for you?
I think it had to do with perspective. Ever since I was a kid, I've really enjoyed like the moment when you're flying out of a city where things are not so abstract yet. They're kind of in between, like they're recognizable, but they're unfamiliar at the same time. Like when you can still see the cars moving and that kind of thing. And so I've just always had this obsession with, this idea that the strangest imaginable things are not far away. They're actually exactly where you are. It's just that you can't see them because of what you're looking for or how you're looking at it. And so at the time, like satellite imagery was the most obvious way for me to access that, where I know that I'm looking at something that's sort of banal that I see in my everyday life. But from this perspective, all these things become apparent about it. Like swimming pools, for example, are often, you know, especially in Las Vegas, they're really weird shapes. Or just the idea of a swimming pool, which is like, it's a hole in the ground with blue chlorinated water that people like get in for a while and then they get out. Like, I don't know, just like
there's so many of them too in some places, right?
Yeah.
That's the shocking thing.
Yeah. And then like as I would do a collection, I would kind of like start to understand like just from the necessity of finding those things, like where they tend to be. So like which cities are going to have a lot of swimming pools and where, or like the fact that the landfill is always kind of like on the, not just on the outskirts of town, but in a certain type of outskirts, you know, like it became almost like anthropological research on accident.
Right.
I had it exhibited in this show that had like people that were like my idols at the time, which is like pretty mind blowing. Like Penelope Umbrico was in that show. And she has that piece, Suns from Flickr, which is like a bunch of people's photos of sunsets on Flickr, where I think she's probably cropped them so the sun is kind of the same size and in the middle. And then it's just this long like wall installation of them. And you know that it's the same thing. There's only one sun. So you're looking at like thousands of perspectives like on the same thing, you know. So there was just a lot of work kind of like that. It was definitely not traditional photography. That's where I kind of got some context about like why I was more interested in looking at street view than like, you know, photography or something, or me making photographs. It was like not interesting.
Right. Yeah. And you eventually did a project where you went out to try and recreate Google Street View photographs though, right?
Oh, yeah.
Is that before?
That actually I did in school.
Okay.
Yeah. That was around the same time that I did the virtual road trip. I would find people on street view doing, you know, whatever, like walking down the street or like drinking a coffee. And then I would go to that spot and reenact. It's just called reenactments. That's the name of the piece. I would just do exactly what they were doing. And it actually was really difficult because of where the camera is. So it meant that whoever was taking the photo had to stand in the middle of the street, which is a little bit treacherous.
Yeah.
But that just kind of drove home the point of that project, which is that people, I don't know, maybe not anymore, but at the time people tended to think of Street View as like somehow timeless, like not, you know, not real time, but just something more than just like a collection of photographs, which is actually just a collection of photographs that are stitched together.
Right.
So in these, if when you see the side by side of like my photo and the screenshot, you can see things like, oh, right, like it's this camera that's normally a lot higher up in the middle of the street, and it was the weather was a certain way that day. There was this graffiti on the wall. It's not there anymore. Like it just kind of as a reminder of
It's just one photo.
It's just one photo, and even if it was taken yesterday, it's still not that thing in reality.
Yeah, I mean, there's something about the fact that you like go to Google and you search this address and like this is the one it brings up that it feels like it's been put in like this canon that like suddenly like this is the essence of Broderick Street, but like it's really just a day or a second,
super
right?
Arbitrary. Yeah.
Is that just general like kind of like messing around with the context of like our world, something, a theme you're trying to pursue in your art?
Yeah. I think for me it connects back to that idea that there's always something interesting right under your nose. Like there's also always something interesting that you could make or see. I think that's right under your nose. I find that like my favorite work is just that it's like someone did something really deceptively simple just because they used something in a way that it wasn't intended to be used. And I think like I like the fact that anybody could do that.
Yeah. You know,
it's just because then it's just your personal perspective on something that's the newness that you're bringing to it. Yeah, I think.
Talk to me a little bit about the recent project that you did. It was called the Bureau of Suspended Objects. It's outside of San Francisco at the dump, basically.
Yeah. It's at Recology.
What's Recology?
Recology is the company that handles the waste for San Francisco. It is colloquially known as the dump. But it's also like a recycling and just like waste processing center. And they have had an artist residency program for more than 25 years, I think, at this point. And as an artist in residence, you get to go in for like three or four months. You get a studio and then you get access to the public disposal area, which is not the trash that, you know, like you're throwing out and the garbage truck is picking up. It's customers coming in and kind of unloading, like decluttering, you know, throwing things off the back of their trucks.
Right. So it's not like straight up like eggs and
no.
It's like junkish.
It's junkish, yeah. Like the smell, which I get very nostalgic about the smell there. The smell is like a musty hoarder's garage smell.
Right.
Yeah. You get a shopping cart, which I just love that irony. You go in with your vest and your steel-toed boots and your helmet and your shopping cart. And you just get to, you know, day after day, just take whatever you want. And obviously there's, you know, been a lot of sculpture kind of stuff there. And people have used the paint because there's this gray that they make out of all the leftover paint.
Hmm.
And it's just always the stuff that people do there is always amazing.
Did you feel some like responsibility to look at what the canon of art made through the Recology, you know, artist in residence program and not do the same thing? Or did you not even pay attention to it? Or
no, I mean, I was familiar with it because I always go to their openings. They're like the best art openings. There's also a free pile of stuff that the artists didn't use that you can just like, as someone going to the opening, you can take.
Right.
The Bureau of Suspended Objects came out of a specific moment before my residency had even started. I and the other artists were getting our orientation in there. And so we were we call it the pile. We were in the pile for the first time. And you have to be very kind of vigilant in there because there's a lot going on and there's a lot of vehicles and, you know, you need to be like safe and just like aware. So you kind of have to get in and get out. And I was just kind of like standing in front of this pile of stuff and I was just like really bewildered. And Chris Sollers was the other artist. I remember him like handing me this baseball. It was a super old baseball. I've like never seen a baseball this old. And I was just standing there like staring at this baseball. And like you can't do that in there. You can't just like stand in there and just stare at something. And they were like, Jenny, you know, get out of there.
It's just that hectic. There's like trucks everywhere.
Yeah,
there's just,
yeah. And like the point is you're supposed to go back to your studio and right. like figure that stuff out. So the Bureau of Suspended Objects, like it came out of this impulse to like want to spend time with every single thing in there, which is obviously impossible. And that's why the whole the project where I just basically researched to like an unreasonable degree sometimes 200 objects, like where they were made and what they were made out of and why they were made. It has the feeling of like an endurance project. Like I didn't need to do 200.
Right.
I mean, I could have done 100. And
I mean, were you fast? I mean, were they all fascinating? Or I mean,
yeah, nothing is not fascinating.
Right.
Like, I mean, the most, the, I mean, that's kind of that was the lesson of that that project. Like you, I mean, you could pick up anything in this room and look at the label and start going down that wormhole online, and it's just everything. Especially the most banal things, you know, are the product of like an intersection of a lot of really unstable and weird and bizarre, not given things. People just they're like, oh, Jenny can figure it out.
Did you end up having like favorite objects or certain discoveries that really surprised you? Or I mean, did you find like the $100,000, you know, king of Egypt, or like, you know, gold watch or whatever?
No, I just found like I just really liked the weirder things, like I actually did not find this in the pile. The people who worked at the dump found it and gave it to me to research. But there was a very water damaged Silicon Valley board game from 1980.
So you're like, it's like you're raising money and you're that kind of like.
Well, it's like pre-startup in a way. So and the guy who made it doesn't really seem to like know that much about tech. So like the ways that you get money are like. Renting your Tahoe cabin or like and then it's like start a bookstore or like I don't know, it's like not what you would expect. But I grew up there, and so all of these like Valco, which is this like now defunct mall that I used to go to as a kid, is like on the board. HP is on the board. Stanford is on the board. It's just like a really weird artifact of like this one guy who went to high school with Steve Jobs and just seemed like very enamored of that whole thing,
right.
And decided to make a. He also made Gilroy Garlic,
right?
Which is another great board game. Didn't find it in the dump, but yeah.
How did you end up presenting the work?
The
project.
It just looks like an archive or a library. So it's been actually shown in other places. It was shown at the dump,
right.
At the end, and then.
Well, so what was that like for people who are just listening? How do they envision that? It's like you walk in, it looks like a museum kind of, I mean, sort of
yeah.
set up displaying objects, little cards.
Yeah, it was kind of like a cross between an archive. It was a little bit more dense than maybe a museum would normally be, but it definitely, you know, there were just white walls, white shelves, white pedestals, and then there's just these very carefully placed objects, and then each one of them has the official Bureau of Suspended Objects tag, which has my stamp, the title, and then a QR code that you could scan, and it will take you to all of the research that I did on that. So there were actually people who came back on a separate day to read the rest of the things. Like there were actually people going through and scanning and reading like about every single object, which I thought was really amazing. I don't know what it's made out of, and I don't know what it's for. So in the book and online, it just says this is an unknown object produced for unknown reasons in an unknown location.
Right. So one of the things I read about was, as you were talking a bit about what you hope people will use technology to experience your work and just generally in the world. So you, in this case, you have something that's set up sort of like a archive/museum, and then you have people using technology to like interface with the actual curation and research, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Is that how you intend or hope people will use technology? Did that sort of fit into your?
So there were kind of two components, techie components to that show, and one was the scanning of the tags, and then the other one was this augmented reality thing that I had set up where I had photos of this, you know, quote unquote trash item, and then I had gone and found the product photo for that thing, and I had it set up where if you had this augmented reality app and you would hold your camera up to the print on the wall, the new version of it would be overlaid on top of it, which is actually very simple to do. It looks complicated.
It sounds complicated.
It's not complicated at all. And similarly to with the tags, doing that was supposed to give you further insight into that object, or you think about like how you're seeing every object you're seeing is at some point on its like trajectory to the dump. But something kind of that I didn't foresee was that people just got more excited about the augmented reality than they didn't actually look at the thing on the screen or on the wall. They just saw like, oh, this artist used augmented reality.
Right.
Or people were like, wow, this artist put tags on all these things and you can scan all of them, but then didn't scan any of them or didn't read any of them.
Right.
You know? So I've always had to kind of negotiate how I use technology or how technology is used in experiencing my work, because I really, really don't want it to overpower the ultimate goal, which is like, that show is really not supposed to be about me or about technology. It was supposed to be about the objects.
Right.
So how to kind of keep the focus on that.
So how's that influence like how you think about it in the future?
I don't know. I'm kind of still working it out right now, but I've been just trying to pay attention to examples of work where there is some sort of technological mediation happening, but then you walk away from it and you have kind of like, you know, actual augmented reality. Like you go outside and you see kind of more stuff or you see things differently. And I think that's something that is like hands down I find productive, and that is like a worthwhile use of any tool.
Yeah.
You know, like, and that's something you can really give someone. Like you can really I remember seeing a John Cage performance years and years ago at the symphony, and you know, John Cage, his whole thing is like, I don't need music, like sound is the music. And I know that, and I'd read about him, but I saw this performance and I can honestly say that I have never heard sound the same way ever again. And like that's, and I feel like that was a very generous thing, you know? So I think like I'm always going to be drawn to using like technological tools, and I do think they have the capacity to kind of do that, but I'm only interested in it insofar as like I can offer that to other people, like add something to their experience.
Right. I mean, I'm sort of like asking about this and staying here just because I think it's something that maybe not in the context of art specifically, but in the context of people's lives that people can really relate to, right? Which is people go to concerts now and or to restaurants and they really want to like cherish the moment. So they take photos of the food or at concerts.
Yeah.
They're so excited to be there. And so
small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Favorite artists, they want that photo and that video, but that experience becomes really like mediated in a way. And, you know, I don't know if they go home and are like really happy to look at the pictures of the thing, or if they ever do, or I don't know. But I think that people can really connect with that. It's so difficult these days to decide when to use these things and when it enhances the experience and when it feels like you're supposed to use these things and maybe it takes away from it. And then so much of it is just based on like observing other people and what they're doing and maybe even unconsciously following that, like that's just what people do.
Yeah. I mean, you go on the train now and it's like, yeah, if you're looking around, you're you're the only person looking around.
It's super easy to take a photo of all those people on their phones and be like, get off your phones, people, right? But then 5 minutes later, you're just like one of the people on the phone. So it's, maybe you're not, but I am.
I struggle with it like everyone else. I've been sort of interested in how things can proceed inward and outward from something like your phone. So if you're here, if you're in a familiar place and say you're on the BART and you're like, the BART's boring. I'm going to just kill this time with, and your phones are really good for that. I'm just going to do this random stuff or whatever. But I was recently in Sweden and people in Sweden love speaking English, but none of the signs are in English. And I was alone for a lot of the trip. And so I have that Google Translate app where you point your camera at things and it translates them in the camera.
Right.
And I was having to use that all the time. I was having to I was standing in the grocery store, Googling, what is cheese in Swedish, And I really was relying on it to tell me what was actually there. It was the opposite of I know what's there. I'm not interested. I'm going to look at this thing on my phone. So that's kind of, I don't know if I'm going to end up doing anything with that, but it's something that I think about, that it can really go both ways.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, on some level, it's directions, even Waze, how many people who are using Waze to give them directions to places that they've gone to 1,000 times, but now feel like, well, maybe this one time there'll be a huge traffic accident or something. So I better have Waze on to make sure that I don't get in some sort of an accident.
But, and I think it also has to do with that example in particular. Something that I think about a lot is optimizing, people wanting to optimize everything. So the reasons that people will do that in that situation is that they want Google Maps to tell them the most optimal way at that particular time to get to that place.
Right.
And that's humans are very cerebral animals. It's really easy to go down that road in a pretty OCD way.
Yeah.
And not sort of leave anything to chance or I don't know. Personally, I feel the unexpected is always going to be more interesting than anything I'm going to come up with. So I really want to leave space for that. And if it takes me, 15 minutes longer to get somewhere.
Do you think that's just becoming more aware of it and training yourself to not do it? Because, I think you could – what you just described there, you could apply to a million little wormholes on the internet, right? I need to have the best travel – doing travel plans and you could go down there or want to eat the best restaurant. I don't want to waste my time.
It's
everywhere.
Totally. You can drive yourself crazy. I think people are driving themselves crazy with that currently. So, I'm not immune to that. I definitely can see down that road. I honestly feel everyone, and this phone is terrible for this, everyone could just use a minute most of the time. So everyone could just chill out for a minute and look up from your phone and just kind of look around and be okay, what is this actually about? What do I actually want? I just want dinner.
Right.
Just dinner, period. It doesn't have to be the best dinner. Maybe I just want to eat some food and be surprised. And and then if you find something that's good, it's exciting because it was on accident.
Yeah.
I don't know. I sound like an old person now.
No, I think everybody sounds like an old people person. Yeah. It's a huge thing that's happening, right? So it makes sense. So you lived in Silicon Valley your whole life. Maybe you don't live there now, but
I live in Oakland. All right.
But you grew up in Silicon Valley. Yeah. If anyone has some opinion on what's happening in Silicon Valley, California, in the tech world, when you look at it now, what do you think?
I think maybe the most Silicon Valley part of my life is teaching at Stanford because I am teaching a lot of students who then, go on to work at these companies. And that whole kind of optimization thing is something that in context is something that I worry about because I see people designing things that we now all of us use to communicate with each other and all this stuff, designing those from the point of view of efficiency, not to mention profit.
Yeah.
Just the culture that would come up with Soylent, where it's I don't have time to eat food. I have a lot of problems with that.
Yeah.
And I find it really concerning.
A lot of these things are things in your day-to-day life, and they seem sort of trivial, but they actually are really like what define people's humanity and their relationships. And I mean, it's like literally what you spend your time doing. And so when you make these huge changes in those places, it can feel really like disconcerting. Like if suddenly you don't go to restaurants anymore and you just eat Soylent, like that's a crazy change.
Yeah.
In addition to being crazy, it's also, you know, like people eat together and talk
right.
together.
Like, yeah, it's like these textures of interaction and like daily life. Like I was just hanging out with a friend in Sweden who like never – he just like never looks at his phone, like compared to most people I know. And so I didn't because it seemed rude like
right.
to do it in that context. And then like after a couple days of that, like I started to feel like really different from just not looking at my phone.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And we – like I think we all know that the stuff on our phones is designed to be addictive, like in a lab rat way. Like,
yeah.
I mean, it's not that far from casino design. So those are like intentional design decisions that are being made. And then, yeah, and then they're affecting these like very personal and private like spaces of your life.
Tell me, I read that you were a resident at the Internet Archive.
Oh, yeah.
You were an artist in residence there?
Yeah.
Tell me about that. What did you end up doing while you were there?
I did kind of a bunch of stuff, but I think the main thing, so I really, I guess I kind of mentioned this earlier, but I often think that things that kind of already exist or that I find and am surprised by are better than anything that I'm going to make. So I'm not usually very intent on like making anything in the traditional sense. So I was going through the archive and I found this whole collection of Byte magazines, like BYTE.
And so is this like Byte. The physical archive you're going through?
Or no, this is online.
You're in front of a computer going through
computer,
the archive.
Yeah.
Okay.
Although I did visit the actual archive building.
Right.
But, so Byte magazine, it was like an 80s era computer magazine. And it's kind of from the time when computers were like a hobby. Like you would mm-hmm. you would build your own computer.
Right.
And it had the most amazing ads in it. And the ads are like
it's kind of like if computers and Make Magazine were, right? It's like that sort of – like it's a DIY kind of culture, but it's for computers, which people don't think of anymore because people just buy computers now.
Yeah, and you don't like tinker with them. So the ads in the magazine are all for like, you know, computer stuff or computers. And they – I don't know if it's because they were just kind of – trying to figure out the visual language for this very new thing, but there are all these really strange visual metaphors in these ads. Like there'll be like an Apple II looking computer with like a cop hat and a riding crop in front of it, and it says "Pay attention," like just like you know. And then or like there's like a giant pill and it's opening. And there's a computer chip coming out. Some of them are really like disturbing, and so I started just like pulling those out and just kind of in a almost like Richard Prince way, just like taking the text out. But leaving the background in. So it's just – you're just presented with this, like, kind of surreal and disturbing image, which I tried to pick the ones that are inadvertently maybe seem prophetic, like, in retrospect. Like, the computer with the cop hat looks like surveillance now. Or, like, the pill with the computer chip looks like biometrics or something.
What do you think they were trying to say then?
I think they were just –
bad graphic
cheesy.
Design. Yeah.
I don't know. well, there was a lot. There's a lot of like things are always like really like sparkly and in outer space. So it's like you know it's definitely this like self-conscious, like we are telling you about something very futuristic right now.
Okay.
but then like, now you look back at it and it reads really differently.
What was it like working at the archive?
Did you sort of
end up having? I mean, it seems like it slightly ties into the stuff that you were doing at Recology.
Yeah. Sure, yeah, and it similarly but, overwhelming
because
right. there's just so – I mean, there's a lot of Byte magazines, and that magazine is often hundreds of pages long.
Uh-huh.
And you always know that there's more good stuff in there. So it was really hard to just like – yeah, the exact same thing that happened at the dump. It was really hard to cut myself off and just be like, this is – okay, I have the material. I'm just going to work with this because, I could have gone through there forever. But it's also this like euphoria of finding, which – one of my best friends was also in residence at the archive at the same time, but she happened to be in Korea at the time. And there was this period of the day where, with the time difference, we were both online. And we were both kind of going through these old computer magazines at the same time and just excitedly sending each other. Our entire iMessage conversation is just like screenshots and then like OMG or like LOL and then like more screenshots. So it's just like, it was really like, it really made me think about how much I prefer that over, like, trying to make something from scratch. Like, it's just not going to be – you can't make that stuff up.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, also interesting about the archive is that it's like what's it going to be like in the future when people go back and look at this stuff? Like, it's so devoid of right? It's like sort of what you're presenting is that it's like it looks comical or scary or whatever it is now. At the time, it's hard to know what it really looked like.
Yeah.
To those people who made those ads, I guess, right?
Yeah, right. And then it's really easy to extrapolate from that and look, you know, you don't have to distance yourself from our, like, current ads that much to
right.
be able to see that happening in the future, you know?
Like, yeah.
how ridiculous the stuff that we have now is going to look. And everything is always cutting edge, right? And then, you know, 3 years from now, it's going to look ridiculous.
Right.
No one will even remember it.
Yeah. We wrap up. What are you working on now?
Right now, I've actually been doing more writing, unexpectedly. Yeah, just like some. I don't know if you saw it, but like I wrote this weird report, Bureau of Suspended Objects report on this watch.
No, I didn't see that.
So my friends did this project called the Museum of Capitalism. And they had like an object drive, so people were bringing in artifacts of capitalism. And someone brought in this watch that he saw advertised for quote unquote free on Instagram. It's like the crappiest watch. I mean, I wish I could give it to you so you could feel it. It's like the literally the cheapest possible feeling object. And it's $7 shipping. So it's like a semi-scam company,
right.
Where they're obviously making money off of shipping. But speaking of wormholes, I just, on this one object, it led me down this, like, crazy path of there's, like, this fake company that's pretending it's San Francisco, but then they have a clone and it's in Miami. And then you find out that they're all getting their watches from the same sort of cheap watch supplier, probably, and then photoshopping things out and, like, fake storefronts and just, like, it's just crazy. So it's just, like, it's a PDF. And, like, I put it up just because, you know, I was like, here's this PDF. And then everyone kept, like, sharing this PDF.
And it's like a feature, basically sort of a feature of like, here's what's happening. There's this
yeah.
thing that's going on.
Yeah, yeah. And I think like it was a good, maybe it was like a really succinct illustration of like the scam that like branding is in general. It's like a really obvious example of that, but it's something that everyone sort of sees happening. So like, yeah, I think there's always been a lot of writing in my projects and I think maybe like the writing is maybe just becoming like a bigger and bigger part of it. Because it, as an artist who likes to kind of do like deep dives on things, like that's writing is like, it's the most basic kind of way to open something up like that. And I've been really amazed with the patience that people have. I've written some really long things and people appear to be reading the whole thing. So I just want to thank like everyone who read the entire watch PDF.
Where can people find the watch PDF?
It's on Topic.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a nicer version. Then you don't have to read it. Now it's like a real, you know, they designed it and it's not a PDF anymore. So if you go on Topic and you just search like, I don't know, free watch or something, it'll probably come up.
Awesome. Jenny O'Dell, thanks for joining us on the Webby Podcast. We're so appreciative.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thanks so much to Jenny for sitting down with us. We've linked to a ton of the work we've talked about in the show notes. If you want to see some of the mundane things we see in our everyday lives through an anthropological and digital lens, spend some time with her projects like the Satellite Collection and visit her site for more at jennyodell.com. You won't be disappointed. Our producer is Sebastian Adey. Our editorial director is Nicole Ferraro. Research and writing by Jordana Jarrett. Music is Poddington Bear. Claire Graves is the L train that's on time with no one on it. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week with our last episode of season 2.